years ago, Amelia Earhart and her navigator Fred Noonan disappeared over the Pacific Ocean without a trace. All over the world lie scattered pieces of her puzzle, waiting to be put together. Welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. I'm your host and the project creator, Chris Williamson. Hello and welcome to the Chasing Earhart podcast. This is your host, Chris Williamson. This is episode 5 of Chasing Earhart. Thanks for tuning in with us. Before we get started, I want to talk a little bit about a couple of things that we have coming up in the coming weeks. The first is the Astonishing Legends joint podcast that we're going to be recording with them. Look for that in the next month or so. We're very honored and happy to be part of that, that podcast and sitting in with those folks. They've done an extensive amount of research on Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan dating back to 2014 and their original retrospective two-part series. And we're going to be sitting in with them this time on their follow-up and our joint podcast with them. So be on the lookout for that. Head over to astonishinglegends.com or just search Astonishing Legends on iTunes and Google Play, and you can listen to their podcast. They do a great show. So we're happy to be aboard with them. Secondly, I want to talk a little bit about our announcement teaser trailer. We are hard at work on that right now, and we will be giving everyone, the entire world, a taste of Chasing Earhart for the very first time visually on August 31st. So in just about a little under a month or so, you guys will get the first taste, and we will be announcing that on social media, and we'll be announcing that on our YouTube page, which we have also coming up, which I'll talk about in a moment. But the announcement teaser trailer is unlike anything you've ever seen or heard when it comes to an Amelia Earhart documentary trailer. As a matter of fact, it doesn't sound or look or feel like a documentary trailer at all. So we're very excited to present that and to bring that to you guys and give you the first taste of Chasing Earhart visually. I did mention the YouTube channel. We are hard at work on making that YouTube channel come alive, and we're going to be debuting that YouTube channel in the next couple of weeks, hopefully. The YouTube channel is going to spotlight the over 100 guests that we have on the project. So the idea here is that we are going to be releasing 5 to 7 minute videos. They're spotlight videos, and those videos in particular are going to highlight specific guests and their know-how, their knowledge, their expertise, how they relate to Amelia Earhart. We have a lot of great guests coming your way, a lot of people you wouldn't expect to see pop up in an Amelia Earhart project. They're going to be on their way to you via YouTube. So look out for that, and we will also be announcing that on our website, chasingearhart.com, and our social media, Twitter, at Chasing Earhart, and facebook.com/chasingearhart. Now, on to our guest this week. Our guest is Bill Snavely. He is actually in the middle of writing a book right now, and on his hypothesis that he's working on Amelia Earhart. It's a very fascinating hypothesis concerning Buca, and we're going to be talking with him about that hypothesis and getting into it. Now, this particular hypothesis has some math involved, so definitely get out your calculators, get out your pencils. We're going to be going to school with Bill Snavely here in just a little bit, and we're going to be discussing what he believes happened with the final flight of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan, and he has a lot of very interesting things to say. So we're going to be speaking with him and getting into the details of his hypothesis and his work and what he believes his feelings are on Miss Earhart, Mr. Noonan. So Bill Snavely, you're up.
So Bill, thank you very much for being on the Chasing Earhart podcast. We're very excited to have you. Welcome aboard, sir.
Thank you.
So what I want to do with folks who might not be familiar with your hypothesis or with the work you have, we're going to start by asking the same question I ask every one of my guests. Can you tell us a little bit about your education and your professional background?
Sure. I grew up in Storrs, Connecticut, went to E.O. Smith High School, went on and got a bachelor's degree at Muskingum College in Ohio, the same place that John Glenn, the astronaut, initially went before he went in the Navy. And then I went and got a master's degree in social work at the University of Connecticut.
Okay. And then as far as your professional background, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. For a number of years, I worked for the state of Maryland, 31 year in development disabilities, and also in geriatric services. And on the side, I did counseling at another agency, and I also did some corporate coaching.
So you have a very unique background. What I'd like to ask now is, how did Amelia Earhart come into your life?
Well, I should also mention that as a kid, I grew up overseas for 3 years, 1 year in Italy and 2 years in Beirut, Lebanon, so I spent a fair amount of time in other parts of the world as well. And the issue with Amelia Earhart is, even kid, my dad used to take his dad to the airport to look at airplanes on the weekends, and he always wanted to fly, and yet he felt that it wouldn't be right with a family to have him take the risks of flying airplanes, but he was very much enamored by them. When I was in my 30s, I took up flying and got my pilot's license, and used to take my mom and dad up in the airplanes. And my dad later was able to get his pilot's license in his 60s and flew until his 80s, as did my mom.
And do you know what your earliest recollection was of Amelia Earhart? When did you first hear about her, and kind of how did that kind of creep into your professional work?
I think the original piece occurred when I used to build model airplanes, and I had a plastic model of her airplane that I put together. And out at the local airport that we visited on the weekends, there was a Beechcraft Bonanza that looked similar to the plane she flew, but was smaller than the Lockheed Electra 10 that she flew. And my dad used to say that they were fairly similar in being twin engine airplanes, and so those are my earlier remembrance of it. Also, a guy down the road from me built a real model airplane in his basement, and we used to discuss whether you could build an electric model airplane that would fly, so you could fly longer than the gas model airplanes that we were flying at the time. That was kind of how my interest grew initially. Also, growing up in Connecticut, I was not that far away from some of the places she'd been in Boston. And as a social worker, looking back, she had also been a social worker herself.
Yeah, she had many, many different jobs, we'll get into that in a little bit. But what I wanted to find out is I think for a lot of folks out there who may not be familiar with your work or familiar with your hypothesis, can you give us a brief overview of what that hypothesis actually is?
Sure. As I looked at things, I was shocked that after 80 years, or back then I guess it was probably 60 or 70 when I first got started, that they hadn't been able to uncover where she had landed. And that kind of surprised me. And I'm just a little bit of a maverick, and I decided to do something very different from the other searches. I studied her fuel usage for a couple years, and then when I retired from the state of Maryland in 2005, I decided to go over and start near where her route began, not at the end where she was supposed to land in Holland. And so I went over and spent time in Rabaul with the idea of taking a look and listening to their oral history over there and not assuming anything. And the thought would be to go to the closest place it could have been to her takeoff, where she ended up, sit down, ask questions, what can you tell me about, and just let the natives talk, rather than assume. And the thought would have been that I would have moved from Rabaul, then over to Buka, and then farther until I hit at least the Gilberts, because I found out that 70% of her route was never searched.
So let's talk about that. That's pretty interesting and fascinating to me, just as a researcher and for what we're doing with the project. You did mention earlier that you've traveled and you kind of spent time with these folks, and you kind of just let them tell you their point of view and their kind of where they stood on it. And you also mentioned that 70% of the route hadn't been studied, or maybe most people were focusing on a particular section of the route. Can you talk about your approach in general to that first 70% of the route, and what made you want to study that part of the route, and where you think the keys are for that?
Well, in looking at the route and looking at the flight, it's like any other situation where you're trying to determine where something is. If you're not looking at 100% of it, I think it's a waste of time. In fact, somebody close to the search said to me one day, you know, Beth, the only thing we can tell for sure, it's not in the 30% where they've been looking for 80 years. It must be someplace else. And when I was up with the Smithsonian and they were asking me questions, they brought in somebody from Air and Space, and we were talking, and I said to them, well, no one has ever searched Buka, and the person said, oh, yes, the whole route's been searched. I said, name the person that searched that area. I want to know. And they put their head down on the desk because they knew that wasn't the case. They couldn't give the name.
Why do you think...
Go ahead. My whole thinking is, if you can't explain systematically that 100% of the route was searched, we've not done a thorough job.
Why do you think that that's the case? There's so much attention, directed at where she landed and, the last part of her flight. Why do you think that first part of the flight, or the first, let's say, three quarters of the flight, there wasn't that much attention paid to that particular part of the flight, or maybe that particular part of the route? Do you think that maybe people are just kind of focusing on one specific part and just kind of are throwing out the parts that seem to go okay? Or what is your theory behind why that wasn't actually selected and why that wasn't combed over in the same manner as, let's say, the last quarter of the route?
I think it's very clear. The thought that the individuals had was that because of the amount of fuel she carried and where they thought communications occurred, it would be impossible for it to be any place outside of that 30%. I've actually, in the studying of it, flipped it, and it's just the opposite of what's been thought all along. But what's interesting and intriguing is once one person says it's got to be this, a lot of other people follow, and after 70 or 80 years, it gets to the point where everybody thinks that's got to be the truth. Because somebody said it, and it's been passed on and passed on from one generation to another. But ironically, it's not the case. And when she said, we must be on you, the Itasca assumed that was a boat that was stationed near Howland Island, assumed that she was talking to them and that she must be very close to them. And with the radio communication going in and out, sometimes they couldn't hear her at all. Sometimes it was skip, fade in, fade out, and sometimes it be as if she was next door to them. And that's just the way the radio communications went. And so there's an assumption she's got to be there. Ironically, Howland was clear during that time of day, and there was no storm. She was complaining of being in clouds and in a storm. And so they first sent all the search out to the northwest of Howland, which was the closest they could come to any place that was stormy at the time. Ironically, it was storming over Buka at the time. I'll get to that later, but I wanted to throw that in. I think it's simply because of the way people approach it. They approach it sincerely. They wanted to find her. The U.S. government was looking for her. The military, the British were looking for her, and George Putnam, her husband, was throwing in his tidbits and hunches of what islands to look for. Ironically, if you look at the Gilbert Islands and you go east from that and include Howland, Baker, and Gardner and others, those areas were searched. But really nothing that I've ever seen was ever done to the west of the Gilberts, and that's 70% of the route she flew. That includes everything from Lay, Papua New Guinea, including close to Rabaul, Buka, Nauru, and so on up to the Gilberts. None of that was ever searched. I know they're tiny islands, I understand that, but at the time it was seen as there's no reason to search there. It's got to be in the area of where that the 30% was because of the call-outs.
Okay, so let's break this down a little bit. So we're going to talk about the last part of the flight, and you touched on it a little bit. We must be on you, but we cannot see you. In your opinion, where is she when she's sending out those transmissions?
When she's sending out those transmissions, and if you let me go through it, I'd be glad to go through it in a systematic order. Would that be helpful?
Absolutely, yeah. Fire away.
Okay. What I've discovered is that there are at least three facts that are not well known about her final flight. The first that is really devastating, and I was not even fully aware of it until January, her fuel tanks couldn't be filled to the max for that final takeoff at Leh. She had, depending on who you talk to, a capacity of 1,130 or 1,204 gallons. I'm not going to argue that, quibble that. But ironically, she could only carry 950 gallons, and that was dictated by the weight at the runway length. That was the max for what we call a max envelope. That's the maximum that she would have been able to carry and still get off on that distance of the runway. The second fact that's not well known is she expected winds of 12 knots and had no idea she would hit sustained headwinds of 26.5 miles an hour. It was even blowing at over 20 miles an hour sustained at Hound, her destination. And due to the South Pacific trade winds, were not fully understood until 1943. And we know that because the day before she took off, she said to somebody, the clouds and the wind are blowing in the wrong direction. Well, they do for a six-month period of time, and then they switch. The third fact that's not really well known is due to the headwinds. If Amelia insisted on continuing the flight, she would have been over 326 nautical miles short of Howland Island had she proceeded. Instead, she turned back, which was her only chance of reaching an airfield at Buka. She radioed three times at 14:15 Greenwich Mean Time, at 15:15 Greenwich Mean Time, and at 16:24 Greenwich Mean Time. The Itasca could hear her and make out the fact that it was Amelia calling, but they couldn't make out the words. They heard her say overcast and cloudy, and that was it out of a transmission. It is likely that she announced she was turning back to land on the only runway she could reach and thought they'd heard her. After all, if she reached Buka, the around-the-world flight was still on. She could retrace her steps and try again. If she pushed it and ran out of gas over the water, the around-the-world effort would have been over and both Amelia and Fred would die. And in a minute, if it's okay with you, I'll elaborate on each of the issues that I brought up. Would that be helpful?
Of course, that would be great.
Sure. Chris, I think one of the things that surprised me the most was the actual fuel with which she took off from Leh. She had a capacity in the plane for anywhere up to 1,130 gallons or possibly even 1,204, depending on who you talk with. But what I didn't realize that the problem she faced at Leh was with a 3,000-foot runway, there were weight limits as to how much fuel she could carry and still take off. And according to the specs that I've seen reported, it was fairly limiting. In fact, they asked Noonan the night before, how many gallons are you going to fly out of Leh with? And he said 950. And a guy from New Zealand challenged him, and he said, that doesn't make any sense to me. Why would you fly with less than 10% extra needed for any other conditions that you experience? And he said, look, we're right at the weight limit right now. And the weight limit on the plane is as follows. The plane empty weighed 9,200 pounds. If you include Noonan at about 145 pounds and Amelia, for argument's sake, at around 125, you're at 9,470. And if you add the 950 gallons of fuel, which each gallon weighs 6 pounds U.S., you come up to 5,700 pounds. And the totals of that would be 15,170. Plus, we know she carried two suitcases, one raft, and they were charted in books. So, in any event, she was close to the 15,300 max weight limit when they took off. And the thing to remember is, the only reason she would be able to take off on that 3,000-foot runway with 15,300 pounds was she had the newer 550-horsepower Wasp engines. The one thing that was difficult, though, was Lockheed's recommendation was made on a paved runway, and she actually took off on an unpaved runway. And it was still warm air when she took off and starting to really heat up outside. The plane on takeoff hit a bump, and one of the pilots that happened to be flying above the runway at the time looked down and said that there's a road that crosses the runway in the last 50 yards, and they literally bounced into the air in what we call ground effect. In essence, the ground was holding the plane up, which is a very dangerous condition. And when the plane flew over the end of the runway, it disappeared below the cliff, and it was carving circles out with its engines a few feet over the water until it flew out of sight in the distance. Obviously, no more fuel could have been carried than the 950 gallons, and they cheated death, but it's not exactly one of those things that one would recommend normally to do. So that's the first limiting factor that I wasn't even fully aware of until this year. The second limiting factor was the wind. Amelia was not aware of the winds in the South Pacific area, and the day before she took off at Ley, she said, "The clouds are and the wind are blowing in the wrong direction." The South Pacific trade winds blow for 6 months east to west and switch. And it wasn't until 1943 that the British reported this phenomenon. And so after the takeoff, even though it was calm on the runway, Amelia ran into a sustained 26.5-mile-an-hour headwind at altitude. And she'd only expected a headwind of about 12 miles an hour, and was thrown by it. And even at Howland at the time, it was blowing sustained at over 20 miles an hour. Ironically, it took them 7 hours to reach the New Kumano Islands. Fred reported in an hour later than expected for the first third of the trip. They were averaging only 107 nautical miles an hour. Harry Balfour reportedly convinced them to fly over Nauru. The phosphate lights were to be on the island at night. And a lot of people are not aware that she flew over Nauru at all. But Paul Rafford, when he took all the call-outs for the Smithsonian, found record of it in there. And she sure enough had flown over Nauru. And there's a report of her saying, "I see the lights," and the folks on Nauru, including the police chief, heard her as she went over. And that was just over halfway marker, and she was 2 hours late in arriving due to the continued headwinds. During the first hour of the flight, it would be anticipated she could have burned up to 100 gallons of fuel getting to altitude. In fact, they said the plane was so heavy that it was carving circles in the water pretty much until it went out of sight. If we look at 48 gallons burned per hour from hour 2 through 12, she'd already burned up 628 gallons by the time she got to Nauru. And this would have left it with only 322 gallons remaining to cover 955 nautical miles. They needed 427 gallons to get to Halland. Also, if 16 gallons to 40 gallons was unusable fuel due to some left in each of the tanks, instead of being 296 nautical miles short, they would have been a full 326 nautical miles short of Halland. And Fred would have confirmed and would have come up to the front from his navigator station in the fuselage, and I'm sure would have reported it to Amelia. Their options would have been to turn around immediately and try to land at Rabaul or Buca. Rabaul would have been 908 nautical miles away and would have required 258 gallons of the 322 gallons remaining. Rabaul had a 3,000-foot runway. Buca was even closer and had a 2,300-foot runway. After the difficulty of a takeoff and the hard flying, Amelia was probably not pleased with the news that they were low on fuel, and they may well have discussed it with Fred for the better part of an hour before they turned around. Going back, Fred Noonan likely would have taken over the flying at about 13 hours. She had a very exhausting takeoff and battling the headwinds. And if you look at the flight that she made across the Atlantic, she hit a fatigue at about 14, 15 hours. If you look at her first flight around the world, going to Hawaii from Oakland, she flew for about 14 or 15 hours and asked Paul Mance to take over and land the plane. Paul Mance thought she was kidding, but she was dead serious. She was exhausted. So I think probably at about 13 hours is a high likelihood that Fred took over and flew the reciprocal back to Buca, which would have taken 5 3/4 hours at 133 nautical miles an hour, based on the call-out times that they gave. And due to the tailwind, they would have been burning an estimated 38 gallons an hour. Amelia and Fred arrived back over Buca, according to calculations, at 5:42 local time. They circled, in all likelihood, to point the plane to the east to get a sunline at Buca. A more detailed account of this appears in my book on tracking Amelia Earhart, scheduled to be published by Paragon Press. Buca had a heavy rainstorm with thunder and lightning at 2014 Greenwich Mean Time. And even at 1,000 feet, the airport at Buca was 12 miles to the east from where they were flying at 2014. They'd overshot the airport by 12 miles and were unaware of it. A boy on the beach at Matsungan Island saw a plane with the left wing on fire ditch near the beach. He reports there were two people working their radios. The plane drifted and later went down under the water near the island. At the same time, Nauru reported a female voice, no hum from the engines, and a girl in Florida named Betty may also have heard the call-outs. What I find really interesting is only 30% of Amelia's flight path has ever been searched, which absolutely is blew my mind when I first saw it. 70% has gone unsearched for 80 years. And the reason is because of radio assumptions. The quote, "We must be on you but can't see you." One person close to the search declared the only thing you can take from the 80 years that the search is on for the plane must not be in the 30% that has been thoroughly searched. In January, I spent about 12 days trying to reconstruct the last flight as completely as I could. And I came to the conclusion that she was short on fuel and had to turn back. But the question is, all right, what about the radio communications? And starting from the beginning of the flight, Amelia was in touch with Harry Balfour for close to 8 hours. Then she mysteriously got off the radio with him when she could have stayed on longer. And the question is, why? Well, remember, at 7:20 Greenwich Mean Time, they flew over the New Kamano Islands, and Fred Noonan would have realized that the ground speed was only 107 nautical miles, and they were an hour late to the New Kamano Islands. He would have done his computations and forwarded the fuel shortage problem to Amelia via the fishing pole, fishing line that they use for communication. I'm sure she was unsettled by the fuel news and would have concentrated on the fuel analyzer to try to balance things as well as she could. At Naro, she mentions the lights ahead, and they were nearly 2 hours late. There are at least, as I see it, three call-outs from Naro, after Naro. At 14:15 Greenwich Mean Time, the Itasca heard her call. At 15:15 Greenwich Mean Time, they heard her call. At 16:24 Greenwich Mean Time, they heard her call. But they could not clearly make out any of the words other than cloudy and overcast. And I think in these three transmissions is the key to the entire mystery. Amelia would have had her debate with Fred Noonan, and he would have taken over flying the plane, probably. She would have been working the radios, and I feel certain she said, "We're turning back to land at Buka," since the hour discussion with Noonan at Nauru no longer gave him the option of Rabaul due to low fuel. Buka was their last chance to land on land with a runway. And after announcing her plan to turn back, she would have assumed they heard her at Howland. Her effort would have been focused on raising radio contact at Buka or Rabaul, neither of whom would have had their ears on in the middle of the night. They were simply not expecting her. This also explains her constant change of frequencies. At 17:45 Greenwich Mean Time, she says, "I'm about 200 miles out, approximately." At 18:15 Greenwich Mean Time, she says, "I'm about 100 miles out." The importance of this lack of specificity did not escape Paul Rafford. He'd worked for NASA and had been in telemetry at Houston when the crippled Apollo 13 reentered the atmosphere. Paul also wrote a book called Amelia Earhart's Radio. And when he communicated with me, he said that she should have had a sunline and known exactly where she was at 17:45 Greenwich Mean Time and at 18:15 Greenwich Mean Time. However, the answer is she was flying west, and a sunline can only be gotten flying east. One more clue that she flying west is at 19:12 Greenwich Mean Time, she said, "We must be on you but can't see you. Unable to reach you by radio, we were flying at altitude 1,000 feet. She was over Buka, looking for Buka in a thunderstorm, according to my theory, and at 19:28 Greenwich Mean Time, they started circling the plane in order to face east to get a sunlight over Buka to confirm their location. Fred Noonan would have also had his almanac in case he was unable to get a sunlight at the time. Interestingly enough, their final communication was at 20:14 Greenwich Mean Time. We were on line of position 157-337. We're running north and south, presumably looking for the airport at Buka, which was 12 miles east. They'd slightly overshot. And soon after the 20:14, a boy on the beach at Matsungan saw a twin-engine plane with the left wing on fire, run out of gas and ditch along the beach. The boy said both of the people in the plane survived the crash and were working their radios until the plane sank. At the same time, Naro heard the call-outs on 6210 kilohertz without engine female voice. As previously stated, Betty in Florida reportedly also heard the call-outs. What is interesting about the line is several times she used the frequency 7500, which is solely a military channel, which would not have been available to her had not the military installed a 7500 crystal in her plane prior to her trip. Obviously, there was some degree of involvement with the military. I do not believe Amelia ever said KHAQQ calling Itasca. That was what the sailors of the Itasca wrote when she broadcast. She actually told them, speak in English, not code. Also, the strength of her signal would have fluctuated greatly as it skipped. One minute she'd fade out, and another would sound as if she was in the next room. It's even possible that Betty, a girl in Florida, did hear Amelia's actual transmissions for help. The plane's left wing was burned and bent back in the landing. The plane sat precariously balanced on a K until the tide and current picked it up and moved it. It went under the waves less than 2 hours later, approximately 100 meters from Matsungan Island, where it reportedly rests today in 35 meters of water, if this is Amelia's airplane. And at this point, all I'm willing to say is consistent with the plane she flew. The plane that we're looking at is now covered by coral and sand. Only the cockpit, engine, and twin tail poke up out of the sand. The storm was so loud with lightning and thunder, only the boy on the beach witnessed the crash. When he tried to tell the other villagers, the plane had sunk and they called him a liar. There the plane rested until 1996 when some village fishermen spotted the plane and the boy, now an old man, was vindicated. The old man talked to other villagers about the plane before his death in the year 2000. Most of the search efforts in 1937 were made by the U.S. government and military with the assistance of the British. George Putnam, Amelia's husband, also called in hunches of islands to search. Initial searches were made to the northwest of Howland since she reported overcast weather. Ironically, it was clear at Howland. They also searched 30% of her route from the Gilbert Islands and to the east past Howland, Baker, and Gardner Island. Searches were not conducted, to the best of my knowledge, from Lay to the Gilberts, which was 70% of her route. Due to the interpretation of the call-outs, we must be on you but can't see you. They simply didn't know what they didn't know that was likely said in Amelia's first three messages to the Itasca. That the Itasca received, but it couldn't decipher. Ironically, the storms and clouds were over Buchan and Matsungan Island. There have been, since 2005, five different sets of divers we've sent in to try to explore the plane that we're looking at, which seems to be so far consistent with the plane she flew. Chiolo, a free diver, rediscovered the plane wreck in 1996, followed by John, who did some diving off of a garden hose from a compressor, following which Stephen Walcott from Rabaul tried to dive, and then followed by Ken and Peps from Port Moresby, who actually did film and did send us five pictures from the plane. Since then, another diver, Elijah, has gone. There's quite a bit of current. There are also times when the water gets quite stirred up, but there's only certain times when you can really do well with the visibility. What we found so far in the five pictures that I sent to Lockheed in 2012, Lockheed reviewed the plane pictures that we had, and they said, we can't rule it in, we can't rule it out. Interestingly enough, at the time, they were backing another search party and said they needed more evidence. So what we've got is a plane that has twin tails, twin engines, toothpick props. It's not a warbird. Navigator's hatch, and there's no other door near the cockpit. There is a door in the back on the pilot's side. The plane is the same length as measured underwater as her plane, per the divers. Your steering wheel's not sticks. The compass is in the same location as Amelia's. It has a split window in front of the cockpit. And what was described by the divers is what appeared to be three large aluminum tanks inside the plane, which at an angle, you wouldn't see the dominoes or the ones on the floor, but it would look like three large tanks. And there were only two planes ever built like that, and the other one is was destroyed in Russia. It has intake ports that are reportedly visible on the outside of the fuselage pilot side. And at this time, there are what appear to be remains in the plane. There's a table in the fuselage that's broken down inside the fuselage, reportedly similar to the one Fred Noonan uses for navigation table. There's also a 3-foot by 4-foot piece of skin metal sheeting that's come loose due to rusted rivets. And since they were steel, they rusted through. And you could look into the nose cone on the co-pilot side, and there's a suitcase that appears to have monogrammed initials on the suitcase that read GP. Question is, did Amelia fly with her husband's luggage? Does the GP stand for George Putnam? Presumably, the suitcases would contain the first day edition stamped envelopes that we know the plane carried. I'm excited to say there are four experienced divers from Port Moresby who are ready to dive to the site to give us the final answers to whether the plane is Amelia's or not. The cost of initial dive to do this would probably run about $65,000. And to completely clean the plane off of coral, if it proves to be Amelia's, would probably cost an additional $170,000. At the moment, we're just interested in an initial identification in order to find out who lost their lives in this plane. Was it Amelia? Was it Fred?
So essentially what we're talking about here is that she was flying towards Howland. That was her intended destination, but everything started going wrong. And so she decided to play it safe, and she went back to where she knew she could land, and that was Buka. So can we talk a little bit about that decision for her to play it safe? Do you think that came from her? Was it a joint decision between her and Mr. Noonan, or was it something that Noonan pushed? How do you think that decision came about, and when do you think that decision came about? At what point during that flight did that happen?
Yeah, I think it happened right after Nauru, because we hear her saying, "I see the lights ahead," and she was entranced by that. Noonan, who was would have been in the back of the plane doing the computing and using a fishing line of all things to pass messages back and forth to her, would have had his second reading of going over land, so he could have gotten his ground speed directly off of that, and he would have been shocked to find out they were 2 hours late, I think. So at that point, I'm assuming that he would have come up to the front of the plane and explained it to her. And I would imagine they probably had the better part of an hour discussion over it, because I'm sure Amelia probably wanted to continue on the route, if at all possible, because it had been hard enough taking off. And she'd been flying the plane for the better part of 12 going on 13 hours and was over halfway and probably would have wanted to continue. Rabaul would have been 908 nautical miles away going back with a tailwind, and they would have required about 258 gallons of a 322, and it was real doable had they turned right after the lights at Nauru. And Rabaul had a 3,000-foot runway. Buka was even closer at 2,300. And my thinking is that they discussed it for quite a while, and she was tired from the flying and probably turned the plane over it temporarily to have Noonan fly at that time, because because she would have been exhausted after 13 hours of flying that thing straight. And so I'm guessing that that may well have been what happened. And using the computations for the call-outs, I can get a rough estimate that they were flying the reciprocal back to Buca, which they'd flown over on their way out, and it took them at a guess, at my best guess of it, based on the call-outs, 5 3/4 hours at 133 nautical miles an hour, because they had a tailwind, and they were burning about 38 gallons per hour, leaning it out as much as they could going back.
So they're going back to Buca, essentially, and that's kind of the hypothesis here. Can we talk a little bit about let's really get into fuel, because I mean fuel is really kind of one of the points that's been argued by a lot of folks out there who are working their individual hypothesis. Can we talk a little bit about what her fuel consumption would have been? I know you touched on it a little bit here, but as far as the unexpected roadblocks they were running into with headwinds and things of that nature, can we talk a little bit about what low on fuel means? Because she did state, obviously, we're running low on fuel, but we really don't know what that means or what she meant by that or what she decided was low on fuel. Can we talk a little bit about maybe how much fuel she might have had left at the point that she indicated to the task that she was running low on fuel?
Yeah, they wouldn't have had a direct exact figure, simply because they would have had a guesstimate based on the gauge, and they would have had to be changed. They would have had to have changed between 6 different tanks that they had in the plane, as I recall. And what they would have known is a certain amount of the fuel that's left, that's in the plane, can't be fully gotten out. And that's the 16 to 40 that I was talking about before. Probably isn't usable fuel. It all depends on where they said that. And I've got some additional ideas on where they were when they said that. And that's crucial. Were they near Howland or were they near Buca when they said that? Critical. And as I said, there's no way that I can get the mileage to go. They would have been 326 nautical miles short of Howland had they proceeded. Had they continued and said, we're going to come in on fumes or whatever, they couldn't have come in on fumes. They would have been at least 326 nautical miles short based on the math.
And math is big on your hypothesis. It really plays a big role in it. Can you talk a little bit about just the mathematics that are involved in kind of coming up with these numbers and this hypothesis and how you utilized math just for some of our younger folks who might be listening who are currently maybe in high school or even in college or something and are working on a lot of math? Can we talk a little bit about how that plays into this real world hypothesis with Amelia Earhart?
Lockheed had given some information out about fuel consumption. We know that she could lean things out on a very still day, hanging in the air with as little as 38 gallons per hour burn, but she couldn't do that for the route. Normally, when she flew many of her flights, she was averaging about 48 gallons per hour burn rate on it. When she was absolutely full of fuel and weighed as much as she did with that plane with the 950 gallons, it's anticipated she was going full throttle until she could get to altitude. The Lockheed information, Paul Mance and several of the other writers have put down what they anticipate were the various burn rates that she could use. And Paul Mance wrote down in very, very fine detail what that would look like and what it should look like, if possible, but he had no idea the headwinds they were going to hit, which would have forced them. The question is, did they burn, they would have been burning running at the rate of 100 gallons on takeoff and getting up out of there. They said the plane was still just hovering over when it went out of sight, so it had to climb to 10,000 feet. Whether you take it as 100 gallons for 20 minutes, which one of the books did, or whether you take it for the full hour, they would have had to back it back to 70 and back to 70 again. So either way you compute it, it comes out almost identically the same. But I have her burning 100 gallons that first hour to get to altitude, to get to 10,000 feet. And in so doing, that was typical, and that's one of the things Paul Mance used to say about her, was that she tended to go full throttle. And if I'm hovering over the water like that, I think I'm going full throttle too.
Do you think that they planned for, you know, there's a lot of talk about how this route was planned and how this trip was planned. There were a lot of very smart people involved. You touched on Paul Mance a little bit, one of the smartest men alive, basically, at that point when it came to being a technical advisor. And then, of course, Amelia was very intelligent. They had Fred Noonan involved in the celestial navigation part of it. There was a lot of people, you know, it was a team effort when it came to kind of planning this thing out. But there were obviously a lot of aspects of the flight that they didn't anticipate that actually ended up happening. And you touched on a little bit of it with the headwinds and things. Was there, my question becomes, was there room for error in the planning when they came up with this? Were there, did they think about, you know, hey, if you run into headwinds, if you run into this, if you run into that, you're going to need to burn more fuel. So we need to apply accordingly for this. Was that, do you think that was talked about? Was that discussed, or was that something they just completely missed or just didn't assume that would happen?
I give the benefit of a doubt. I don't think it was known back then what those trade winds were and the power of them. In the South Pacific, it wasn't discovered until the British discovered it in 1943, believe it or not, during the war. There was no understanding of that power, that for 6 months it blows in the same directions. I asked the natives over there, would she have had a headwind or a tailwind? They said, tell me what time of year it was and I'll tell you. And I told them, they said she would have had a headwind. But outside of the U.S., that was not known. So I give them the benefit of the doubt. It wasn't something that they intentionally overlooked or were not making the effort. This trip of hers, as John Glenn used to say, was the equivalent of going to the moon back then. All the pieces that had to fit in place. I'm absolutely saluting both Amelia and Fred Noonan that they pulled off as much as they pulled off. And as I'll talk to you, there's even more to it that I think they pulled off that wasn't known at the time. I do think they turned around. They were both smart as a whip. Both good pilots, both capable, and I think they worked together right to the very end on this stuff. I think what happened, but I'll discuss later, was some totally unexpected things. I think they turned back, and I think they did just exactly the right thing in turning back, and I think they turned back in time to still make the airport. So, in defense of them, they were tremendous flyers. No question about it. I'm just going through the things that, in hindsight, we could look at, we know now that they wouldn't have known then.
What do you think? Was there, you know, it just baffles me. There you have this world flight, which is an incredible feat. You know, there just didn't seem to be much of an emergency plan involved in it. There was no contingency plan. There was no plan B. Do you think that they just had to kind of come up with a plan B off the top of their heads? I know you mentioned, you know, of course we all know how insanely intelligent they both were, but do you think there was a plan B in place for anything in the event that they're flying over these huge amounts in these vast areas of ocean in case something were to happen?
I looked at it in hindsight, and there are only two things that would have gotten them through. One, if they'd waited half a year until the wind shifted, which they didn't know at the time. course they'd taken off from Rabaul initially. And I often wondered, why didn't they take off from Rabaul? Well, I studied everything I could. It's true that Rabaul had a volcanic eruption 2 months before, but Rabaul had the same length of runway, 3,000 feet at the time, had good tower service at the time. But the reason they chose Leh was because that's where the New Guinea Airlines was based. And so that's why they chose that. But that was 4 hours of extra flying, and it never made sense to me on that long a flight. So if they'd taken off from Rabaul or they'd taken off half a year later, the trip would have been a piece of cake for them, not for me, but for them.
Let's put a little bit of a myth, maybe not put it to bed, but let's just kind of talk a little bit about it if we can. It's widely circulated and widely talked about that Miss Earhart and Mr. Noonan had a disagreement the night before the flight, or even a couple days before the flight. Do you think that happened? And do you think if it did, do you think what that disagreement might have been over?
The only things I will say is Amelia was had a bad case of dysentery that she got a few days before in the trip. The fact that she could even climb in the cockpit and fly with the strength that she flew is incredible. I don't know anything definite about any discussions or arguments. There are rumors that fly back and forth. One of the rumors that flew was that he was drinking two nights before the flight, and she was not happy with that. And George Putnam, her husband, was putting pressure on her to get back by July 4th, which she couldn't do at that point because of the weather. And so she was under tremendous pressure. I'm sure from everything I've heard, George climbed spryly into the cockpit on the day they took off, and that's all I'm going to talk about. And when they took off, I think both of them were giving it their best. So I'll leave it at that. But the only thing I heard was a slight spat from a day or two before over the fact that he was drinking with a friend of his there at Leh, but nothing with alcohol the night before they actually took off.
So let me ask you this. It's been there are so many people that are out there working their individual hypotheses, and I've you know, stated in the past that maybe this is just one large puzzle that everybody's kind of working on, and working on their own section of the puzzle, basically, to kind of try to put something together here that's definitive.
Well, I don't. I try to link up and I try to connect the dots, and that's probably one of the differences in what I'm trying to do with it. And I've got some more pieces of these things that, if you want me to go through, that'll answer some more of those questions that you have. But go ahead first and let me know what questions you do want to ask first.
Well, I think, you know, I think it's wise to do that. Let's go through those pieces, and let's just kind of I'll turn it back over to you, and you can take it, and we'll go from there.
Okay. If I think that they turned around, they were burning 38 gallons per hour, and Amelia and Fred arrived back, I think, over Buca at 5:42 local time, and they circled, which is really interesting. And I'll go through it a little bit more. Paul Rafford worked in telemetry. He's dead now, died in December, but I talked back and forth with him, and he was responsible for figuring out where Apollo 13 would land, and he was in telemetry. Bright guy, was a navigator in the South Pacific before that, and what he couldn't understand was why did Noonan and why did Amelia say we're about 200 miles out? We're approximately 100 miles out. He said that doesn't make any sense. They should have had a sunline and they should have known exactly. Well, here, Chris, is one more subtle cue to what I'm saying. If they were flying west at that point, there is no sunline going west. They were having to approximate, which is one more clue to what I'm saying. And at 542 over Buka, the Itasca has them circling. And I'm saying that in all likelihood, I think it was to point the plane toward the east to get a sunline at Buka. That's how smart they were. Now, Buka at the time was in the middle of a thunderstorm, heavy rain, thunder, lightning at 2014. And they were flying at 1,000 feet. According to my calculations, they had missed the airport at Buka, totally overcast and in heavy rain and thunderstorm, by 12 miles. And they were flying at 2014. And according to what I'm looking at, there was a boy on a beach in Metsungan, Iowa, that looked up in the morning at about 2014 Greenwich Mean Time, saw a twin-engine plane with the left wing on fire and saw a ditch near the beach. Hey, if they were looking for Buka, they had enough fuel at the time to just make it in that far, and they're looking for Buka. Anybody, even the best pilots, could have missed the airport. And what the kid on the ground said was that the plane ditched near the island. Two people were working their radios. The plane drifted and later went down under the water near the island. And it was at the same time that NARA reported a female voice, no hum from the engines, and a girl in Florida named Betty may have also heard the call-outs. So that's to complete the other piece. In January, I spent 12 days trying to reconstruct the flight. And I came to the conclusion she was short on fuel and had to turn back. But what about the radio communications? That's the key. Starting from the beginning of the flight, Amelia was in touch with Harry Balfour for close to 8 hours. Then she mysteriously got off the radio with him, which she could have stayed on for longer. And the question everybody asks is why. Well, here's the deal. Remember that at 7:20, they flew over the Nicomano Islands, and Fred Noonan would have realized that their ground speed was only 107 miles an hour when they were going over the islands. And he would have done his computations, figured out an initial fuel shortage, would have put on a fishing pole up to her for communication and said, hey, here's the news. I think she went to the Cambridge analyzer and started really going over carefully the fuel usage at that time and didn't have time to talk with Harry Balfour because of that. By the time, as I said, they mentioned the lights, they're 2 hours late. Hey, but they called out at 14:15 Greenwich Mean Time, 15:15 Greenwich Mean Time, and 16:24 Greenwich Mean Time. I think that's the key. And those three transmissions, those keys are the mystery to what happened with Amelia. And what I'm saying, in essence, is I think she said, we turned around, and this is why we turned around, and was assuming that they had heard her. All they heard were the words cloudy, and they heard overcast. That's all they could get out of it. But she would have assumed that they heard after those one, two, or three transmissions, and there wouldn't have been any reason for her to continue to go over and over and over it. If she went out to the full 13 hours in discussing back and forth with Fred, it would have taken Rabaul out of the mix to land, and she would have lost, and the only last chance to land on a runway would have been Buka. That wouldn't have been so much of a problem, because at 2,300 feet, she could have come in on it, and I'm pretty sure that they could have probably thrown 100 gallons in that plane and had it light enough to take off and get to Rabaul and redo the whole deal.
So let's do this. Let's assume, for the sake of argument, let's go with this particular hypothesis and say that what you've just talked about is exactly what happened. What happens once she goes down over Buka? The plane is going down. The left wing is damaged severely, as noted by some of the locals there. Tell me what comes of Amelia Earhart and Fred Noonan.
The only The only thing we know for sure is they didn't make it to land. The one kid on the beach saw the plane, watched it. The plane supposedly stayed up for a little under 2 hours and sank about 100 meters off the shore. The kid goes to tell all the elders there what happened, and they call him a liar because the plane's no longer up and they don't see any sign of it, and the thunderstorm was so loud they didn't hear the crash. It wasn't until 1996 that some divers relocated the plane and said, hey, that kid was right. There really is a plane down there. And the local natives weren't even aware of it till then. So the bottom line is, supposedly, the only contact we would have to know what might have happened is a long shot. And that's Betty in Betty's notebook that's out of Florida. And that's the girl that may have heard the same transmissions, and she wrote down everything she heard. I don't know whether it's for real, but it could well be. It was at exactly the same time that Naro heard the call-outs. And what was being said, Noonan's was trying to climb out. Supposedly, he had a head injury, if Betty's notebook is correct, and I'm not saying it is or it isn't. He was woozy at times. She was reportedly trying to get him to call out, to make call outs, and he wanted to climb out of the plane, according to Betty, because it was hot in the plane and he was scared. I think he was wanting to try to swim for the island in the little raft that they had, and she kept trying to ask him to come back, if Betty's notebook is correct. I'm not saying it is or it isn't. And what happened, in essence, was both drowned. We're pretty sure she stayed with the plane, but we don't know that for sure. That's only based if Betty's report is accurate. So I don't want to go out on a limb, but I'm just saying that's the last we know. They did not get a chance to swim for it and be saved by the local natives.
So according to your research and your hypothesis, there is a plane off of the coast, yeah, about 100 meters of Buka. Is it the plane?
We don't know. Can I go over that briefly?
Sure.
We've sent five sets of divers in to explore it. It's in about 100 meters. Teola was the first guy down in 1996, so I confirmed it. I came across this effort because I met Dominic Chara in 2005 at the Hamamas Hotel in Rabaul, and he said, we may know where there's a plane. So what I did was, he said, give me the characteristics of it and call me in 3 weeks, and I did, and all the characteristics matched up at the time. Twin tail, twin engine, yada, yada, yada. So from that, Fiola, who had done a free dive and talked to a guy named David that talked to the original guy that died in 2000 of this year as an old man. John was the second guy to go back in, and he confirmed that there was a plane down there. Teola looked at a picture of Amelia's plane in a book and said, get over here, it looks identical. John went in diving, confirmed many of the same things. Stephen Walcott we sent in from Rabaul, but John wanted to hide the place where the plane was, so we didn't tell him where it was, and so we had a wasted trip. Ken and Peps came in from Port Moresby, saw the plane, filmed it, and later described it, and they measured it. Elijah also has been in and gone down since then. Back in 2012, I sent five pictures to Lockheed, asking them to rule it in or out. They put it with their antique antiquities folks, and they said, we just can't rule it in or out. In essence, we need more pictures. But at the time, they were also backing another search group. So believe me, if there was any doubt of it being a plane, it had told me no. The plane we're looking at has twin tails, twin engines, what we call toothpick props. That means it was a warbird, not a warbird, because they normally had three bladed props. The local locals swear that the plane went down in 1937. There's a navigator's hatch. No other doors near the cockpit. There's a door in back on the pilot's side that's similar to hers. The plane is the same length as hers as measured underwater. There are two steering wheels and no sticks, which means it wasn't military. The compass is in the same location as hers. The split window in front of the cockpit is just like hers. The divers ask, what are the three large aluminum boxes inside the plane? From the angle they were looking at, they would have looked like three large boxes, and those are the long-range fuel tanks. They also spotted the intake ports on the outside, visible on the pilot side. And it's the only one of two planes built by Lockheed with the long-range fuel tanks, Daily Express being the other, which is destroyed in Russia today as we speak. There are remains in the plane. That's all I want to say about it. I don't want to go into detail. There's a table broken inside the fuselage, similar to the one Fred Noonan used. There's a 3x4-foot skin metal sheet that's come loose and rusted through because the rivets were made out of steel. And you can look in the nose cone on the co-pilot side, and there's a suitcase with the monogrammed initials on the suitcase with initials GP. So my question is, did Amelia fly with her husband's luggage? Does the GP stand for George Putnam? Presumably the suitcase contains the first day edition stamped envelopes we know she carried in the plane. So those are the similarities. All I'm saying is consistent with the plane she flew. Right now, we have four experienced divers from Port Moresby who are ready to dive on the site to give us the final answers to whether the plane's Amelia's. The cost of an initial dive to identify it would probably run about $65,000, and to completely clean the plane of coral and sand, provided it proves to be Amelia's, would cost an additional $170,000. At the moment, we're just interested in initial identification in order to find out who lost their lives in this plane. Was it Amelia and Fred?
So that's really wow. That's really a lot of conclusive data, or circumstantial data, depending on who you talk to and how it works. What are you doing as far as your next steps? I know you touched on the cost of sending a dive crew down to actually get absolute confirmation. Let's say that happens, and you get this dive crew that goes down, and this particular dive crew you're working with doesn't have an iron in that fire. They're just there to kind of do a job. Once that job is confirmed, and let's say they do confirm, yes, this is a Lockheed Tenney Electra, this is Miss Earhart's plane, what do you do? What does that do for your hypothesis? What does that do? Does that give you some kind of a sort of a vindication based off of all of the different hypotheses that are out there? And if that is the case, and that is confirmed by an independent third party, what in the world do you do next?
Well, a couple things. First thing I should say is I have great respect for everyone else that's looking for her plane. Just the effort of looking for her plane is incredible, and people don't understand how hard the other groups have worked. If the other groups find it, I'll be the first to congratulate any one of them, and they could just as easily find it where they're looking as I could where I am. We each have our own thoughts on things. The first thing that I think would need to be done is discussions with the family, and I don't want to go into detail about that right now, but I think the family would have a right to make a decision as to what happens. Do they bury both of them at sea where they are and keep the treasure hunters from treasure hunting over it? Do you plexiglass the whole thing and use it so that it's preserved and used as a tourist site to help the locals? Do you bring it back? It would take months with the rivets that rusted out. You'd have to put a literally place a barge underneath it, something underneath it to get it up. It's not inconceivable what it could be done, but I would rather talk with the families and say, what do you want done? I think that's where it should go next.
Yeah, that's admirable. I agree with you. I think that they should have a say in it. A lot of the family would probably want her to rest in peace and just kind of leave it where it lays. Do you think would that be something that you would be, obviously being the one that's credited as finding it, would that be something that you would believe to be, I guess the question becomes, would you be okay with that after all the research and work you put into it, or would you challenge that?
I would be fine with whatever suits the family. I'd be fine. It's from my perspective, it's their decision to make. It's not mine. And same thing with the airplane. I don't want anything from it. I just want the opportunity to write about it. I'm in the middle of writing a book on it right now that hopefully, tracking Amelia Earhart, that hopefully will come out with Paragon Press this summer. That was my main interest. Plus, the guy that's worked with me over there is hoping to build a school for the kids on the island so they don't have to go to the mainland, and a small health set up there so that people that get sick on the island can have some services there. And I don't think that's a lot for him to be asking after all the work they've done over there with it. They've done a lot more work with it than I have from here. But those are the only things we want out of it. Just like to have it solved. I'd like the family to be at peace with what actually happened.
So I just have one more question for this part one of our interview so far. I'm going to ask you the same question I ask everybody else. If, hypothetically speaking, Amelia were alive today and she looked at all this, what do you think she would think about everybody looking for her? What do you think that she would want her legacy to be regarding her aviation career and her impact?
I think part of it's locked into one of her poems. Courage is the price that life exacts for peace. The soul that knows it not knows no release.
So that was Bill Snavely. We hope you enjoyed that episode. There is a lot of information to go over in that episode, a lot of calculations and things. So hopefully you followed along. If there's anything you missed, please feel free to go back and repeat the episode and listen to the episode again and just grab any information that you need to grab. And we'd love to hear from you about it. So drop us a line at chasingearhart.com. You can also drop us a line via social media and let us know what you thought of that episode. If there are anybody out, is there anybody out there that you'd like us to speak to or that you think that we haven't spoken to yet, for those who've spoken with us or chatted with our team, please drop us a line. Let us know. We'd love to interview more people and have more people on the podcast. Now, in the coming weeks and months, we actually have quite a few podcasts coming up. We have Mark Weekland, we have Candace Fleming, Susan Butler, Dr. Anita Singh Gupta, we have Abigail Harrison, we have Amelia Rose Earhart. There's a lot of people that we're going to be speaking with in the coming weeks and months. Our next episode is with someone you might not have heard of as much, but they're very interesting in the way they've chose to tackle Amelia Earhart, and that is educator and author Brian Herberger. Now, Brian wrote a book called Miss E. I highly recommend anybody who's out there that wants to read a really great book on Amelia Earhart. It's a book of fiction, but it actually has a lot of historical fact on Amelia Earhart. And he kind of took it to another level, which I think has been really fantastically received. And it's a great book for young folks and for young readers, people who are starting out listening to Amelia Earhart and people who like that kind of that fiction flair with a historical fact mixed into it. So we're going to talk with him next episode and ask him how he kind of researched Amelia Earhart and what the process was like for him writing that book and what his personal thoughts are on her legacy and her impact. Also, I want to talk briefly about a very special episode we have coming up in October. The episode is featuring everybody who essentially has written books on Amelia Earhart that are aimed at children. So for that particular episode, we have a very special guest, and that's Brad Meltzer. He will be sitting in with the podcast along with several other folks, and it's going to be done in a roundtable roundtable style format, and I'll be moderating the podcast, and we'll be talking to them about Amelia Earhart's impact on children, especially young kids. And that's something that's never been done. So we're excited about doing that. Be on the lookout for that in the coming months. We'll be talking about that a lot more, and we'll be promoting that a lot more. And we will see you next week. So thank you so much for tuning in to Chasing Earhart. This has been episode 5, and we will see you in 2 weeks with Brian Herberger.